Yes. How you doing, Reggie? Let's play around with this mic here. It's a little low today. Why is it so low? Brumpum. Anyway. All right. What do you say, my friend? Let's do a little podcast for the folks, okay? All right. Can you dig it? I knew you could. All right. Here we go. Clear the instrument. Instrument ready. Is producer ready? Yes. Engineer ready. Very good, sir. All right. Put it down in the books. Number 406. 406. Okay. All right. Three S's. Star, smile, strong. All right. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. Don't forget, part of being in this podcast family not only includes listening every week, finding a spot within your day, within your week, to grab a listen, but also it means to get out there, taking it to the streets. I ain't blind and I don't like what I think I see. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell anybody who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Your loyalty and devotion and elbow grease is much appreciated. If you like what you hear, don't forget, there's more of this to be had. Oh, years and years of weeks and weeks, years and years. You go to WGNRadio.com and you go to the prompt for a podcast. You go to the prompt for this podcast. And there they are. Scroll down, load more. Scroll down and load more. We've done a lot of these. In fact, this is episode number 406. 406. So, as we talk to you today, this week will be brimming with gossip and news and tidbits and you name it, because the next time that we talk, we will have had the Academy Award the Academy Award ceremony, the Oscars. And a week from today, we will be knowing who received Hollywood's biggest prize, the Mount Rushmore of Hollywood, if you will, the Mount Everest of there's many faces on the Mount Rushmore of Hollywood, but not as many on the summit of the Mount Everest of Hollywood, those who have taken home the coveted golden statue, the Oscar, if you will, signifying their excellence in movies for the past year. And everybody knows, should know, if you listen to this podcast, that I'm a big fan of films. In fact, I started my career in print journalism. I always wanted to be on the radio since I was 12. But the radio world, it's not an easy... Well, today it's even harder to break into because there aren't really many radio stations. But back when I was a young buck, it was a hard industry to break into because it was so popular. And you could sort of tell that by now. Look how many people have podcasts. Well, I mean, today all you have to do is buy a nice microphone and get some software and boom, you've got your own radio show. Now, whether somebody listens to it, that's another subject. But there are only X amount of stations and X amount of air shifts, and that was it. And so if you had a dream like I did as a little kid to someday be on the radio, it was not an easy business to break into, and still isn't, as I said, even though it's changed very much. And so while I continue to pursue radio and made, you know, audition tapes and things like that, I was also interested in a career in the media. And so I found print journalism jobs were a little easier to come by right out of college as opposed to, you know, radio. Today, it's a whole different world. Back when I was just, as I said, beginning, there was the world, you know, there was less, you know, we live in a society now in a world with options, with more options. It's more of a do-it-yourself world. And when I was just out of college, it was still the old school, and it was still, there were X amount of opportunities, X amount of in this case, radio stations or whatever, and the jobs, especially in the media, were in demand, in great demand, and a lot of people, I mean, today, now, everybody can just, you know, you only had one outlet. You had to work, if you wanted to be in the business of communicating with and to and for people, whether it was communicating news, whether it was communicating on the radio with music or with talk, you know, there were X amount of ways to do it. It wasn't infinite. There were newspapers, there was television, and there was radio. And then there was the growth of cable, and there was, you know, some cable access, at, you know, stations at that time as well, as cable stations were emerging. One of the reasons why cable was allowed, really, to expand as fast as it did. You know, I was talking in a previous podcast about television and broadcasting and pay-per-view and streaming and how the government is very concerned as broadcasting and technology expands and becomes there become more pay-for-view or pay-for-services out there that we are disregarding those who don't have enough money or can't afford to pay for these things. And so there's always a concern that and a responsibility that there is free entertainment and information out there for people. Even today, you know, look at how, if you watch your television, you see how they always talk about there's free things on TV. You know, get a digital antenna and rescan your antenna, and you will find a plethora of different stations over the air as more pay services are out there. The government is trying to assure that everyone has free access to entertainment and information. And so in the early days of cable, one way that, because it was such a huge shift in the paradigm, going from, at that time, you know, television viewing was always free. For the most part, there, you know, there was some cable television, and that's where cable really started, in the far reaches, you know, outside in rural areas. That's where cable television really started. It was more of a way to give people in rural areas that were you know, that couldn't get access to free over the air programming because they were in such, say, rural areas that the signals from the TV stations could not penetrate or reach that far, or because they were in wooded areas and there is a lot of, trees. You know, at the end of the day, don't forget, you know, over the air transmission, and even when we have, Wi-Fi, it's crazy to think that all this stuff is flying through the air in these invisible signals. It's really crazy. I think it'd be wild if we were able to use an infrared type of light and just flash it, and if we could see all the different wireless connections that we're walking through on a daily basis in our house, as well. You know, if you've got a router for your for your Wi-Fi, there's invisible signals being sent everywhere from your phone and from your television and everything. It would be hilarious. I'm sure, and if you go outside, my gosh, there's got to be signals everywhere, and we'd probably be ducking everywhere if we saw so many signals. I understand they're probably very high. They're not, but I'm exaggerating. But I'm saying to really, if we were able to bring them down to eye level, we would be ducking. There's so many weird signals and frequencies that are happening all around us. If people lived in a rural area or very far out, the signals wouldn't reach them. And so the idea then of the cable was invented for those people that lived in those rural areas or areas that were not able to receive the signal clear. Then, well, let's deliver the signal straight to their house. You know, you have a, back in the old days, and you still do, some people still have, antenna television, which is a nice little plug there too. But you have the antenna on your television. Okay, so the antenna is pointed out into the air, into the sky, and those signals hit that antenna. As crazy as it may sound to us, it's hard to fathom that there's invisible signals and frequencies floating around there, but they are, and there's proof in the pudding. And but for those areas that where, like I said, that's, for instance, a very wooded area with trees or obstacles in the way, those signals do not have a clear, a clear path. And so then the idea was, well, let's deliver this programming on a wire and deliver it right into the set, not through the antenna, but the wire with the programming comes into your house and into your set. And that's what cable television really is. And the same thing with satellite. You know, the satellite is connected into your television from this outside, just as the antenna is. But the cable is much more hardwired. I mean, they're actually bringing that signal, all that programming in that cable wire. That's why they always talk about broadband. You hear about broadband. That meant, don't hear about that as much anymore because you don't use the cords as much, but broadband is basically how much information could be held into that wire that came into your house from your cable system. But now, we don't use that anymore. But anyway, in the early days of cable, one way that they were able to justify the new business model of charging for programming was to say, okay, well, we're going to charge you for what used to be free. And as I said earlier, we wanted our MTV, and so we gladly forked over the cash. But there was this concern, and to make that, to satisfy that governmental concern, cable stations used to provide cable access, they would call it, stations, which were stations that were locally produced shows that talked about the areas that they served. And so that was one way that the cable systems were able to strike a deal. Yes, we are going to be taking away what was free to people, but we're going to be adding some value by producing our own programming that's localized and giving people a chance to hear and see about more free information about where they live and kind of doing a public service, if you will. But as I said, you know, so when I was growing up, it was not easy to break into, you know, the media world. There was just, there was only X amount of places. And I found that that print jobs came a little easier. And so, as I said, I still sent out, you know, audition tapes to radio stations all the time. But I needed to, you know, to get a job and start making a living. And so I also had had writing as in my background and journalism. And so those jobs seemed to be a little easier to come by. There were a lot of local newspapers. And even now that whole business is gone. But when I was a younger kid, you know, 30, 40 years ago, every suburb had their own local newspaper, and there were companies, there were publishing companies that had chains of newspapers throughout a certain area or region, the western suburbs and the southern suburbs and the North Shore all had their own publishing, smaller publishing companies that had newspapers that served the individual suburbs. I worked for a company called Press Publications. I started writing a music column when I was in college for this company called Press Publications, which had a string of, I think, more than 40 local newspapers throughout the western suburbs. They were stationed there. They were their headquarters were in Elmhurst, and the Elmhurst Press was at that time the biggest of all of them because it was the biggest and most affluent suburb in their chain. But then other ones began to grow as well as more populations grew out into the western suburbs. But so that was a good, if you were an aspiring journalist, it was a great place to get your experience and to refine your skills at a local, smaller newspaper. You didn't have as much experience, in the hopes that you can work there, do that work, get that experience, refine your talents, and then hopefully go on to the next level of a bigger paper. For instance, hopefully maybe even someday the Chicago Tribune here in Chicago, the Tribune or the Sun-Times or something like that. Many people started at smaller newspapers like that. So there were more opportunities, at least I was finding. Yes, there were smaller radio stations too, same thing, but the doors weren't as easily open for those. Radio used to be a really cool job. Now it's hard to get into. There's not that many radio stations. They've all folded because of podcasts and the internet and everything like that. So completely different industry now. So I actually started writing about entertainment, music, and then later about other things, film review, theater reviews. I'm an entertainment and pop culture junkie. And so that was right up my alley. So that's where I really got a lot of my abilities and skills honed and got the experience. So it was first on the print side. So yeah, I used to write movie reviews and movie features. Later on, I worked for a couple of magazines as editing, you know, movie magazine and writing stories for various publications. So, my bedroom in between times when it wasn't all Elton, back when I was a young kid, then there were movie posters everywhere on my walls. You could really, I mean, I should have taken pictures of my bedroom throughout the years, because you could really see all the phases of interest and hobbies that I've had. As I said many times about my early childhood, it was all sports based when I was a real young kid. And had posters of Dick Butkus and Bobby Hull and Tony Esposito and Ron Sano in my room, and had different in pennants, you know, of your sports team, Bears and stuff like that, you know, and Cubs stuff all over the place. And then I discovered Elton when I was around nine. And then all of a sudden, the Elton poster started to replace that. And all of a sudden, the whole room was covered. Every available spot was covered with a picture of Elton. I mean, it was on my dressers and on the curtains and on the walls of my, or on the sliding doors of my closets and the ceiling and the mirror and you name it. And then after that, around the 80s, then all of a sudden, I started to take some of the Elton stuff down. And then, as I said, I got really into movies, especially when VHS came out. And you could bring movies home and watch them whenever you wanted. You can't believe the freedom. I mean, once again, young people today can't even fathom that. But, for those of us who are old enough, you remember that if the movie wasn't at a theater and it wasn't on television, you didn't get to watch it. You didn't have the immediate access. Oh, you know what? I feel like watching The Godfather today. No, you couldn't just do that like you can now, and certainly couldn't do it I think I just do it on my phone as I'm, sitting here on the subway or on the, on the bus or, in the airport. No, I mean, the access we have today is ridiculous. So the idea when the VHS player came out, that you could bring, I could watch Casablanca tonight. You mean Channel 9's not, I don't have to wait for the late, late, late show to watch Casablanca. I could just go and rent it. Or I don't have to wait to watch Jaws. I could just go and rent it. Wow. Oh, the freedom was unheard of. It was the liberation that was like our version of a streaming service was the video store, the Blockbuster, your local mom and pop video store. It was unheard of freedom and access to entertainment that had not existed anymore. And I know that must sound like it's prehistoric times, and it wasn't all that long ago. It was about 40 years ago now when it really became into the mainstream. But it was only in the early 80s when the VHS player really began to take hold. We're at by probably around the 40-year mark now, maybe a little, the early 80s, 82, 83, early adopters started to get VHS players. But by 84, it was almost every house had a VHS player. And either recording programs that you wanted to watch, or more likely you had a membership card. Do you remember this, folks? We had membership cards to either a local video store down the block or the big boys, Blockbuster and other ones. My gosh, we had to have we had to pay for a membership card. You had to be a member. It was like an honor and a privilege that you got to go and choose a movie or a TV show or a workout video to take home. It was unbelievable. But so then all of a sudden I became a enraptured in movies, because there was a whole world of movies, old and new and current, that were available to me. And I just was renting movies every day and renting these older films that I'd always heard about and never saw, or recent films that I hadn't seen. Or even then, when it really began to take hold, you could see new releases within a month or two. Could you imagine that? Now we get, some movies are released the same time. It's amazing. In 40 years, what a difference is. But that VHS was revolutionary, just like streaming and just like the internet has been revolutionary now. The VHS player was revolutionary for its time. It really provided an unparalleled freedom now and access to entertainment that it just did not exist. There was only, as I said before, our whole society was limited in the opportunities to do things. It wasn't as vast as it is today. Today it's all about personal freedom and choice and convenience. And back then, almost all aspects of society, like I'm saying, career-wise and entertainment-wise and otherwise, we just did not have the same kind of opportunity and access that exists today. And we all take it for granted. Certainly the younger people who know other reality, that's their reality. But for those of us who are older, we certainly love and take advantage of it as well. But like I'm doing now, we can also remember those days when it was very constricted as to what you can do and how you could do it. So anyway, needless to say, I became a huge, huge movie fan. Always was. Mom always took me to films as a young kid. That was one of the things to do. We're going to go to the movies. As I was a little kid, it was just me and her. You know, Dad was at work. We'd go to the movies. Went to a place on the Northwest Side. It used to be called the Will Rogers in the Belmont Central area. Saw lots of films at the Will Rogers or the Luna, which was on Belmont and Cicero. They were very close to the house, walking distance or a quick bus ride, and that's where I spent a lot of my early youth. I have my mom to thank so much for exposing me to the arts at a very young age. Took me to the theater to see plays, and here I am now acting, right? Went to those movies as a young kid and started my career, writing about movies and music and the arts. So no question that what you're exposed to as a little kid, if you have the drive and the ambition and it really sinks into you, whatever it may be, you know, your parents or your dad may have taught you about cars, and that's how you became a mechanic. Same thing. Mine was the arts and the movies, fine, but whatever, it seems like whatever we get, introduced to at a young age, that where it really connects with us, it really becomes a major part of your life, and it many times becomes your profession. You cannot discount those early years. I know we might think, oh, that's a lot of BS, but it really isn't. At least in my case, it isn't. So certainly for me, the Oscars have always been. And later on in my career, then when I would go on the radio and talk about movies, since I wrote columns and stories and movie reviews, I would go on and talk about films. And that's the way I sort of got into radio, through the back door there, being a guest on shows, through my print work. And I would always say that when the Oscars came up, this is like the Super Bowl for movie fans. And it really was. It was for me. I've told this story that I was so into this that when I got married, every year, this is how into the Oscars I was. Every year, for a good 5, 6, 7 years, I would create my own envelopes. I would make my predictions. I would type them up on a typewriter, showing my age, and then later on a computer monitor. But I would type up my winners, and I would fold them and put them in envelopes, and I would do the 5 major categories, or 6 major categories. You know, the best actor, best actress, best supporting actor and actress, best director, and best film. Those are the top 6. And then I would give those on, I would seal those. I would do this before the Oscar telecast. I would have my winners typed out and the Oscar goes to, and then I would say it in there. I'd fold it, put it in the envelope and seal the envelope, have those 6 envelopes. And then when the Oscars began, I would hand them to my wife. And then as the ceremony proceeded, when those, each specific category was up, she would have the envelope ready, and after the nominees were announced and the presenter would go and rip the envelope on television, my wife would rip the envelope at home, And as the presenter on TV took out the winning, read the winning name, my wife pulled out my winner and read the name. And I always did very well in terms of my predictions. Because, and that's really the point of my of the podcast today. The reason I always have done very well in predictions of award shows is because I have my ear to the ground in terms of the other side, the politics of an award show, the buzz as to where the attention and the Hollywood gossip is leading, and you could see and hear where certain actors or actresses or directors or films are getting the big push, and people are, and you're hearing people just the way you read stories and you see, you know, the, on shows talking about the Oscars, just the way they talk about them. You know, Oscar hopeful, and you see, oh, it's everybody's doing a story on this, everybody's doing a story on that. And you just get a sense of, okay, that's, this movie is in the zeitgeist now, and it's going. And that's, and so many times, even now, I don't see hardly as many movies at all anymore. Sad to say, it's not my fault. I blame Hollywood. Don't blame me. I love movies. I still watch movies. I just don't like the current movies. I like real stories. I like dramas and comedies and real films that aren't filled with computer graphics or aren't filled with superheroes. So if I don't like that, where do I go to see a movie these days? You tell me. Now, actually, I should say that I think that there's beginning to be a backlash. We've been in this fantasy superhero world now where it's dominated Hollywood films. And then, like I said, the rise of the computer graphics have just, you know, catapulted it into the dominant genre now. And there's always been those kind of films. You could argue that the comic book film started with Superman back in the 70s, but I would argue that it didn't really spawn a lot of other ones so quickly. I think the one that really kicked this off was the original Batman film in 1988 with or 89 with Michael Keaton, directed by Tim Burton. I think that was the one. That one just became a steamroller in terms of a box office hit. I think it was revolutionary in how it told the story. It wasn't cheesy. The Superman movie was kind of cheesy. It was kind of cool from a special effects standpoint that the big thing was you will see a man can fly. Now, that doesn't, a man flying is nothing. But back in the late 70s, the technology to, you could see a man fly. That was kind of the tagline for that film when it first came out, because that was like a big special effect. Today, a five-year-old kid can create that on their computer, making somebody fly. But what was significant and revolutionary about Tim Burton's Batman was that it had its share of special effects, but not a lot, really, when you think about it. Not like today, certainly. But you can see that it was the way that the comic book superheroes were told, the way the story was told. It was told in a much darker and in a much more realistic way. It wasn't as supernatural, if you will. It told it, it wasn't, you know, Superman was, you know, truth, justice, and the American way. And that Batman film with Tim Burton was a darker story. Bruce Wayne was a troubled, dark character, you know, kind of conflicted, you know, saw his parents shot right in front of him, right? I talked about being a young kid and what happens to you affecting your life? Well, you know, try that one on for size. That was at the root of the Batman character and his motivation for becoming the Batman, if you will. So just the way Tim Burton designed that film, the look of it, it was dark itself. The perspective in the storytelling was dark. The character, Michael Keaton's character, was mysterious and dark and conflicted. And that was new for a Hollywood superhero film. Usually the superhero was, you know, had a glinty smile and did good. You know, truth, as I said before, truth, justice in the American way. And Michael Keaton's Batman and Tim Burton's Batman was very different. It was based actually on The Dark Knight Returns, which was a comic book in the late 80s by Frank Miller, which gave Batman even this whole new perspective, unlike it was written in the original days where Batman and Robin were, you know, out to break, you know, to fight crime, and they were heroic. In many ways, the Batman characters portrayed by Michael Keaton and many of the characters today are almost anti-heroes in some ways. Yes, they're heroes. Yes, they're out to do good, but it's not as easily clean cut. There's a lot more complicated motivations and feelings involved. And that, I think, was the difference. Now, you can argue, certainly, that Star Wars, I understand Star Wars came out and it changed everything in terms of science fiction being accepted and special effects with George Lucas. I get that. But I'm talking about superheroes. Yes, I understand that Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader could be viewed as superheroes in a way. I understand all that, but that was sci-fi. I'm talking about comic book superheroes. The established ones like, you know, Batman, Superman, Iron Man, and all those Marvel comics and all those DC comics, which we see, are the major characters by which almost every successful film, or maybe not successful film, is based. But I think we're starting to see a backlash on that. They're still out there. Hollywood's still making them. But a lot of times they're just remaking the same ones. How many Spider-Man movies are there? Jeez. You're starting to see maybe a backlash that maybe the movie-going public are beginning to not want to see movies that are aimed at 12-year-olds, even when you're in your 50s. And so this year especially, you can see that. There's a lot of films that were nominated for Best Picture, like The Holdovers, Oppenheimer, that have American Fiction, that are story-based, character-based, reality-based films about the human condition, not about the superhuman condition, which we have been bombarded with for the last 20 years. The Batman series with Tim Burton was a game changer, but really the movie that in recent years that spawned this current domination of the superhero movie really started with Iron Man with Robert Downey Jr. That one really started it. And then you had the new Batman series with Christopher Nolan with Christian Bale as Superman. And that really then solidified things. And then you've had all the various, Superman films and Spider-Man films, and then every major or minor comic book character around there. If you had one comic book, Hollywood has made a movie about you. You know, the Avengers and your Hulks and, you know, your Fantastic Four and all of them. And then, you know, even minor characters like Ant-Man and have become big hits. So they said, well, we can't keep making Hulk films. We can't keep making the same thing. So are there any other characters out there? And some of those have succeeded on those minor characters and elevated those one-time minor comic book characters into major characters, and others have fallen flat on their face. So it really depends on the way the movie is written and the way it's presented. But I think there's beginning to be a small backlash, and people might be wanting now smaller films about real people and real situations. Maybe it's because more people are watching films at home now, and those kind of films, a drama or a comedy, are more adept at being shown on a smaller screen. If you want to, if you don't have a 65-inch screen now at your house, then you're missing out on the impact of the way most of these superhero films are produced. They're made to be big and loud and flashy and effects laden, and that's best seen and enjoyed on a huge screen, preferably at a theater. And now, like I said, the average screen now in someone's house, I would say, is probably 50 inches or more, which is wild. Because once again, 30, 40 years ago, if you had a 25-inch television, that was a big set. Ooh, you got a big screen. Wow, that's a big set. And then they started to make the big screen sets. But a regular normal set in an average home was, if you had 25 inches, that was considered big. That was a big screen. Now you have the 25 inch in your kitchen. But okay, long way to say I'm a big movie fan, and I always watch the Oscars. Even though I don't even see the films as much as I used to, I can still predict the Oscars because I can tell where the buzz is. And there's a lot more factors involved now. We've had all, in our age of diversity here, there's been a lot of controversy that the Oscars have not been diverse in terms of race or gender, in the filmmakers, the actors, the actresses, you name it. There's been a huge push over the last 10 or 15 years to make the Oscars more diverse in who and how they nominate and choose winners. So there's a lot of that goes on. There's politics involved in that, which gets me to my point. So this year's Oscars should be very interesting. It was an interesting year in films. We had two of the biggest box office films in history come out in 2023 last year in the summer on the same day. That is even crazier. It used to be that in the summertime, when the big budget, popcorn kind of tentpole movies came out, the studios would not even want to compete with each other. So like every weekend, when they had their own blockbuster, they wanted that, the other ones, okay, well, the Batman movie's coming out. I'm not putting mine out against that because everybody's going to see Batman. I'm going to wait 2 weeks after that and blah, blah, blah. But something interesting happened this year. Or last year, I should say, in 2023. Because the film industry has changed so much, because we are in this kind of little gray area as we're still trying to figure out, coming back from COVID, people slowly going back to the theaters, but also finding the convenience of watching a film at home, as I said, and as home technology gets better, as the size of the screens get bigger, and the quality of the picture and the quality of the sound, many people are taking the convenience over those and say, I can't replicate 120 foot screen or more in my house, but I could get a 65 inch or a 55 inch and I could get really good surround sound. And that's beats having to pack up the kids or go out to the theater and pay the extra for popcorn and all that. I'll invest in my big screen thing and be in the comfort of my home, and I could pause it and go to the bathroom and wear my socks and my shorts and not have to worry about it. And so right now we're in that was born too out of COVID as well. And so now we're in this gray area here. We don't, the industry doesn't know what to do, and the consumer doesn't know what to do. We like both. We like going out to the movies at times, but we also like staying at home at times. And that's hard for the studios who make these movies to figure out where's the audience. They have to follow the audience, right? But so this year was interesting. Last summer was interesting because you had two films that couldn't be any more different in their subject matter, in their appeal. And instead of them running away from the competition, the studios are so hard up to get people into the theaters and to get all the audience in the theaters, young people, older people, men, women, boys, girls, you name it, that rather than fighting each other, somewhere, somehow, in a strange accident like the Big Bang, rather than these two films being mutually exclusive, the Barbie film and the Oppenheimer film, one about the most popular girl's doll in history, and one about a groundbreaking scientist who changed the world with a atom bomb. You can't get two more diverse films. One is fantasy and one is reality. One is happy and one is a little sad and scary. And instead of them fighting each other, they came out on the same day. And I don't know who coined the phrase, but Barbenheimer, the opening week of Barbenheimer, when Barbie and Oppenheimer were coming out on the same day, not mutually exclusive, not 2 weeks in between, same day. And incredibly, this light fantasy film about a doll and this heavy drama about the invention of nuclear weapons, both attracted huge audiences. At the end of the day, Barbie's lighter side and more summer festive and even female empowered message brought in more people than Oppenheimer's more serious, but Oppenheimer still made a really impressive buck here. There's no question that Barbie made over $1 billion, but Oppenheimer was close on its tails. And considering that it was a period film about this very heavy, deep, complex issue, the fact that that movie at all could draw that much of an audience, at the same time that this perfect summer movie that had all the bells and whistles of a summer hit, bright colors, well-known characters, love stories, hit songs, big names. I mean, it was everything a summer blockbuster is supposed to have. Oppenheimer, in another world, in another era, when the film industry was much more competitive like that, Oppenheimer would have been released at the end of the year. For Oscar considerations only. That would never have been a summer movie. A film with that heavy of a subject that took place in the 30s and 40s. Summer movies are about fun and frivolity and escapism. Back to the Future, Star Wars, Barbie, Mission Impossible. But that just goes to show you how different the movie industry is today. They took a chance, I think, and it turned out to be a winner. And so that's why this year it's going to be an interesting Oscar ceremony, and it's been an interesting Oscar time and nomination period. And there's been a lot of controversy. Because we are in, as I've said many times on the podcast, we are in a female-dominated, female empowerment society right now. And some would argue it's not enough, and I understand where you're coming from. But you cannot argue as well that in all aspects of our society, the female influence has grown in the last 15, 20 years. That's impossible to deny. I was just talking about the Grammy Awards a few weeks ago. I didn't even know if there was a man nominated. All the major awards won by women, totally dominated women. Music, the music Grammy Awards, completely dominated by women. Yes, there's some men won here or there, but the major awards, the major airtime, the major performers, anybody shown in the audience was mostly women. On television, we see female-dominated characters now, where men used to be in the leads and the heroes. Now women are. And as I said, Barbie, you can't get much more women-oriented than a Barbie doll. I spoke about this in the summer when the phenomenon of the Barbie film happened. It was an amazing marketing achievement, because Barbie had been used as by the feminist movement as a rallying cry against the old way. Barbie was viewed as a stereotypical woman, as a sex object who just cared about who hasn't taken seriously for her brain and her mind. It was just dressed in different outfits and had this ridiculous figure that no woman could ever even have in real life. It was an exaggerated physical. Everything about Barbie was physicality. And the feminist movement was talking about, and striving for equal rights and having women looked in a different way, not just as physical objects, but as smart, aggressive, ambitious people who should be viewed in the same way as men in terms of competition and careers and power. And they were able to take Barbie, which you would think, and had been for the last 40 years since the feminist movement started, that was used as the example against the establishment, saying, oh yeah, you're just a Barbie doll, she's just a plastic fake thing. That was the shot. And they actually turned Barbie into a feminist hero through this movie, playing perfectly to the times that we live in. It was a master stroke. There's no question about it. And that's why it made over $1 billion, around the world. An amazing, amazing success. Not just, financially, but also, as I said, content-wise, for many reasons. And so when the Oscars came about, there was huge expectation that the Barbie film would just dominate all the major categories and possibly win because of its daily double success, a hit at the box office as well as its content, speaking to a young and older generation of women and instilling pride and optimism and ambition into women with its message. And so that's what most award shows now have become. Award shows have become less about merit and more about optics and agendas, political agendas, social agendas. There's been more of a move to make awards more representative of a diverse culture. Now, I understand the want and the need for that, but I also think it's also a little limiting, because art at its core should know no bounds, should have no restrictions, should have no agendas. Art should come and be developed and created and offered in the manner of which the artist intended it, and let each person decide whether it strikes them or not. When we start putting restrictions or requirements on art, we're impeding art, and we are removing the freedom and the imagination of art by applying layers of regulations or requirements or expectations on things. So that's why we're also in another, not only is the entertainment world and the business world in the state of flux, the whole world is in the state of flux. Look what's going on in this world right now with the wars we have and all the problems. We are in a very unstable kind of period in human history. And we're clawing for answers. We are rudderless. We don't really have a clear direction as to what is right and what is wrong. We have so many opinions in the world now that it's impossible to coalesce around anything. That's why the Barbie film was so impressive, because, and even the Oppenheimer film, it was one of the few things that everybody seemed to agree on for the first time in more than a decade or so, if not longer, maybe the last 25 or 30 years. It was a communal experience, a communal entertainment experience that we have been moving away from in the last 30 years because of the internet and its ability to give each person freedom and access, like I talked before. We're losing communal experiences of all kind because we are more involved in time-shifting shows, watching things, doing things on our own. We're more of a personalized society than we are a communal society. And there's advantages and big disadvantages to that. But here came Barbie and Oppenheimer, especially Barbie, which drew men and women, certainly more of a female audience, but still men went to see it and liked it. And it really was a coming together, even for a brief period of time, over something that at the end of the day is not as important as our social communal system, and we're so divided here as a country and a world. But at least for a few weeks in the summer, everybody could agree, a great number of people could agree that this Barbie movie was worth seeing and fun seeing and enjoyable. And they all wanted to see it. And so when come Oscar time, the expectation was, and especially in today's world, we equate quality with a scorecard. And that's another dangerous thing about art. Art and popular many times don't go together. I often joke that I've always moved away from things that are very popular and faddish. In my view, many times if that many people like it, I don't know if it could be that good. Because, you know, the discerning taste of people. But in today's world, we judge the merit of something not by its quality, but by the reaction it gets, by the numbers. How many likes, how many views, how many streams. You know, we've been counting the box office records for years now, and it's become a major thing probably in the last 40 years too, when shows like Entertainment Tonight and things started to publicize the box office returns. Now it's a common thing. It's in the papers, so it's online or in the papers every Monday. What was the biggest movie of the weekend? They mention it on newscasts. That wasn't always the case, folks. I know this is crazy. I know it sounds like it was 100 years ago, but it wasn't. The world has really changed over the last 40 years, 50 years. It really has. And those of us who have been around that long, we see it. And we sound like voices in the forest, and we sound like we're ancient relics, but we're trying to impress on people that things could be different from today's reality, because things were different. And some people have to be reminded of that, or some people have to be educated on it because they have grown up in a society that they don't remember any of these things. But so I'm not saying that this is something new. The box office returns have always catapulted populism over merit. But today, our society greatly values that across the board, because of the way the computer and the internet is set up. We have now, there's a whole generation that is born to and consumed with validation by numbers. Numbers validate you. Numbers give you success. Numbers give you opportunities. It wasn't always that way, but that's the way it is today because of the internet and the number of likes and streams and views. People are basing whole careers that the majority of the mainstream people who don't watch that stuff clearly don't even know exists. There are several successful millionaire people out there, influencers, entertainers, who have built careers outside of the traditional way because they realized where the real power is. It's on the people that are on that computer. It's the young people. As I said, many ways, our society right now is based on the likes and dislikes of teenagers. Even more specifically, 14 or 15 year old girls. You don't believe me? Did you see a lot of the commercials during the Super Bowl? What were those aimed at? Did you see a lot of products and commercials aimed at really young girls? Why do you think that was? Because who was watching the Super Bowl for the first time in their lives? Taylor Swift fans, young girls. No coincidence. And so the popularity of Barbie, the over $1 billion at the box office, the demographics of this, the Barbie film, while it was hailed by many critics for being a good film, its numbers, its box office numbers, its success, the amount of money it made, the amount of people that went to see it, the demographics that it dominated in, those numbers, those stats, those likes, those views, those streams, if you will, just a different kind of set of numbers, different analytics, but same thing, still counting, suddenly put Barbie on a different level. Not only was it a popular film, it was viewed as a great film, an artistic marvel, a masterpiece. Now, I don't know if it belongs in that category, but the way that we today assess and view greatness, masterpieces, is about how many people have seen it, how many people like it, how many people view it, how many times it's streamed, how much money it makes at the box office. Sadly, we have always been slave to the numbers, but we are much more slave to the numbers today. And things that have gotten millions of likes and streams and views are catapulted and considered to be of high value when they're not really high value. They may be popular, but they're not quality. And so often quality and popularity get mixed and thrown together, mixed up and thrown together. They're two separate things. Sometimes they combine. Like I talked about the movie Batman before, Tim Burton's Batman. It broke all box office records at the time, but it was also a good film. an artistically interesting and groundbreaking film, as well as popular. So it happens. You can look at the Star Wars films. But at least the first three. Maybe the first two, to be honest with you. Out of the nine, or whatever we have now, or 12, whatever it is, it's probably only two that are really good. As far as films go, as far as quality films go, yeah, I don't know. But the Oscars are about, supposedly, about merit. They should be. Now, as I said, there have been a lot of social pressures over the last 10 or 15 years where political agendas seem to override the true merit of things. And there's some films that wound up sweeping the Oscars that they had the right social or political message, and they're quickly forgotten. They're all the rage, and the Oscars look like they're very progressive and inclusive, and those who are fighting for those rights are all excited on that Oscar day. But then once those Oscars are done, that's all forgotten. And a lot of times those movies that wind up sweeping the Oscars are forgotten as well, because they're more caught up in the hype of what they stand for than what they are. Are they really great films? Are some of the films that have won Best Picture in the last 10 or 15 years going to hold up over time like some of the Oscar winners of the past? Going back, to the 20s? I don't know. I don't think so. So when the when the nominations came out, the Barbie film, based on its billion-dollar box office, was expected to dominate the Oscar nominations as well. How could it not be? It was the year of Barbie. It was the summer of Barbie. It was the year of Barbie. No question about it. In terms of box office, pop culture, influence, communal experiences, all of that. But was the film really a work of art? And that's what the Oscars are about. The quality and the merit of a film, not just the box office. And so, while Barbie and Oppenheimer, the two biggest film box office hits of the year, certainly did very well in terms of Oscar nominations, the biggest controversy that's been happening now during this, when the Oscar nominations were announced in last month in January, or month and a half ago now, in January, was two major supposed snubs. There's always some people that, and films that have been overlooked by the Academy, and there's always controversy. But this year, it seemed like there was a lot more social pressure on it because, as I said before, because of the box office and the likes and the pop culture impact that Barbie had, everyone expected the star of the film, Margot Robbie, to be nominated as the Best Actress, of course, in the lead role of the biggest film of the year, right? A film that was nominated for Best Picture, right? As well as the director, Greta Gerwig, who once again, well, if it's the Best Picture, it made a more than $1 billion. The person, the woman that directed it, certainly should be up for Best Director. Well, oddly enough, the Oscar voters were a little more discerning than the general public. The Oscar voters were not completely swayed by the views and the likes and the streams and the box office numbers. Yes, Barbie got nominated in the best category, best picture category, and got many other nominations. Ryan Reynolds, Greta Gerwig was nominated, not for director though, but in the adapted screenplay category. She wrote the film as well. Several songs from the film have been nominated. It was Barbie was nominated in the categories, as like I said before, that you would expect a summer blockbuster if it was nominated would get. What I talked about before, design that got nominated there too. The look of it, the sound of it, the songs, and the entire package itself. But was Margot Robbie really one of the best actresses in her role amongst some of the other actresses who were in dramatic films that really had to emote and act with other people? Now, you can argue about Greta Gerwig. I mean, she had to put together this pop culture extravaganza that obviously pleased a lot of people. But was it wrong that she wasn't nominated? And are we looking at it just because she's a woman? I would argue no. And I will look at history. The biggest film franchise, for instance, in history is Star Wars, right? Just talked about Star Wars before. Call up Mark Hamill, who was the star of the first three, and who is known as Luke Skywalker. Call up Mark Hamill and ask Mark Hamill how many Oscar nominations for Best Actor he has. You know what it'll tell you? Zero. Now, the argument for Barbie is it made $1 billion. Biggest film, started a revolution. Everybody loved it. Changed the movie industry. It was a dying industry. This year, the numbers were up the roof. Barbie had the views. It made all these things. And the same could be said and was said about the original Star Wars films, of which Mark Hamill starred in. So by today's metrics, by today's expectations, Mark Hamill should have won 3 Oscars as Best Actor as Luke Skywalker. Never nominated for an Oscar. It's not about gender. It's not about misogyny. It's not about, oh, we're going backwards. No, the Oscars are about merit. No question, the Barbie film was popular and a well-made film, an entertaining film. But was Margot Robbie really better than some of the other actresses who may have been in more demanding films like that, and some of the other nominees, like Lily Gladstone from Killers of the Flower Moon? I'll give you another example. Let's use the Greta Gerwig. Oh, how could she be overlooked because she's a woman? Well, there are women in the best actor, best director category. It's not that it's all men. There are women in the best director category. Greta Gerwig just isn't in it. There was a lot of really good movies that were made, not just popular movies, but very well-made films. The Oscars are about merit, not popularity. There are women who are nominated for Best Director. Not Greta Gerwig. This is not about not nominating a woman. It's about looking at the merit and the quality of these films. And I will use the same example. Ask George Lucas how many Academy Awards for Best Director he has. Once again, he's directed several of the Star Wars films. They have made billions and billions. He sold the Star Wars franchise for $4 billion for himself. Star Wars changed the face of Hollywood forever. Not only into sci-fi, but into the big summer kind of movies. It was certainly helped by Jaws a couple of years before, but Star Wars took it to a new level with the special effects and the heroes and the whole thing. No question about that. Call up George Lucas and ask him to see his Academy Awards for Best Director. He can't show you them. He never won one. But why not? According to the argument today, Barbie made the most money, changed everything. George Lucas made Star Wars, changed everything. Why wasn't George Lucas nominated for an Academy Award? Why hasn't George Lucas won for every Star Wars movie that he directed? The movies made tons of money at the box office. Billions of dollars, still do. There's theme parks and video games all centered around this. Toy figures, you name it. According to today's expectation, according to today's Matrix, George Lucas should have 90 Academy Awards, personally. Especially for Best Director. He directed the early films. Why doesn't he have one? It's not about popularity. That's where that's always been the rub about the Oscars. That's why that's why ABC, that televises all the time, has been complaining over the last 10 or 15 years because the ratings have been bad. There's been controversy. That's why they've expanded the list of Oscar nominations to 10 when it used to be 5, because the ABC complained and other people complained that movies that people actually saw weren't being nominated. So if popular films weren't nominated, then people weren't going to watch them because the winners were going to be movies they didn't know about. That's why we have 10 nominees now in the Best Picture category. That happened because The Dark Knight Returns wasn't nominated. And everybody loved that Christopher Nolan film. And so the thought process was, well, let's expand it now and we'll put in some of the films. So once again, Barbie now is in that list. Would Barbie have been in that list if it was only 5 films? Good question. I don't know. Probably not. And if it wasn't, then you could make the corollary, then the best director, then the director of that film shouldn't have been in it. There's only 5 nominees in the director category. So that is a kind of a hint. I don't know if the nominees for Best Picture had only 5 nominees, I don't know if Barbie would be among those 5. So that's a logical reason as to why Greta Gerwig may not be in the 5 nominees. There's still only 5 in the director. Because maybe Barbie wouldn't even have been nominated for Best Film, for Best Picture, if there are only 5. Maybe it's only gotten nominated because that the category several years ago was expanded to 10. The Oscars are about merit. The Oscars are not about box office numbers. If that was the case, three-quarters of the films that won Best Picture on quality and merit would probably never have won because they weren't always the biggest box office film. But popularity, as I said before, does not equate with quality and merit all the time. It can. There are times. But it doesn't always. And the Oscars are meant to be about merit. These are not the People's Choice Awards. This is not about people on the street. It's about people in the industry with a discerning eye for the technical aspects and the knowledge about film. You could say, well, that's kind of snobby. Regardless, we're here about merit. We're saying best, not most popular. That's a whole different world. If you want to have that, you have the People's Choice Awards. You have the Nickelodeon Awards. You have that. The Oscars were created to honor the most quality films and artists in the filmmaking industry. And I would argue that that's what they're continuing to do. So Greta Gerwig has not been shut out. She got nominated in the adapted screenplay category. There was merit. This film, what the film is talked about most is its content, is its message, is how it has taken, as I said earlier, this previously chastised female role model, if you will, that has been the bane of existence for the feminist movement, and transformed it into a feminist hero. That was done with the story. That was done with the screenplay. And so, there is merit in that. There is critical acclaim for that. And so, Greta Gerwig was nominated in that category. So, when you watch the Oscars this week, or if you're mad that Margot Robbie wasn't nominated, remember that Mark Hamill and many other stars of very popular films were never nominated. Remember that George Lucas and many other directors who made very popular box office smashes were not nominated. Those examples are both men. I'm not talking about gender here. I'm talking about merit. I'm talking about quality. I hope we can get back closer to when the Oscars were about merit, because the last several years, the Oscars have been about political agendas. And we are exalting films. I don't know. You tell me. When was the last time you watched Parasite? Or when was the last time you watched The Godfather? The Oscars are not a popularity contest. It might be difficult for people in today's world to understand that, because our society is based on popularity. And it's based, as I said before, on the numerical validation of that popularity. But that doesn't make it right. And it doesn't mean that popularity equals quality. So when you see the nominees and you see the winners, think about that. There's a lot of quality films and quality work out there. I think you're going to see Robert Downey finally win an Academy Award for Oppenheimer. I think you're going to see Oppenheimer win Best Picture. I think you're going to see Christopher Nolan win Best Director. I think you're going to see Lily Gladstone win for Flowers, or Killing of the Killers of the Flower Moon. Merit over popularity. And don't worry, Margot Robbie will get over it. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 406. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears.